Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. Happy Thursday. Joining me once again on the podcast is our colleague, fellow founder of the Bulwark, Bill Crystal. Bill, thanks for coming back on again. Appreciate it.
Great to be with you again, Charlie.
So, you know, as much as I hesitate to talk about Marjorie Taylor Greene again, I do find the whole story fascinating that over the last 48 hours, Kevin McCarthy decided that he was going to condemn her comments comparing mask mandates and vaccine passports to the Holocaust. But as I wrote in my newsletter yesterday, condemns kind of strong because he put out a tweet, a strongly worded tweet, and that's it. They're not going to do anything else about her. They're not going to have a conference vote to strip her of anything like they did with Liz Cheney. She's not going to be censured. There's no indication that the party is going to pull any money. Nobody's going along with Adam Kinzinger's suggestion that they expel her from the party. So, you know, what we have here is Marjorie Taylor Greene out there, and she's just doubling and tripling down that, yes, absolutely. You know, what Nancy Pelosi is suggesting is just the same thing as what the Nazis did to the Jews. And there's pretty much nothing going to be done. And of course, a lot of whataboutism, right? I mean, we've kind of seen this before, the whataboutism, that it's really, let's now focus on how terrible and awful the Democrats are. So Marjorie Taylor Greene, still in good standing with the Republican Party.
Yeah, she's paid no consequence, really, for anything she's done or said. And neither has anyone else, really, on the Republican or conservative side. I think that's just an important thing to keep in mind. Decent people, decent Republicans, decent ex-Republicans, and a ton of liberals are all kind of, gee, this is going to really damage her or damage them. Or, I keep getting this question, I'm sure as you do too, Charlie, why are they still doing this? Well, the beginning of the answer, at least, is they're paying no negative cost, no negative price for doing it. And they're actually getting a ton of reinforcement. Didn't Marjorie Taylor Greene raise, I don't know, $3 million in the first quarter or something for a reelection, which incidentally means that if a decent Republican primaries her, she will have a ton of money to beat that back. And as you say, it's not clear that the Republican Congressional Committee won't support her as they support other incumbents. So they don't pay a price. There's no consequence. There's positive reinforcement, of course, from a ton of people in right-wing media and the Trump base of the party. And then, as you pointed out, there's also Donald Trump himself.
Yeah, and of course, you have this the playbook. They're going to pivot to the whataboutism of talking about that the real problem is Democratic anti-Semitism. I think the thing to watch, of course, is what does the Republican base think about all of this? It's kind of early, but there was some initial blowback among some of the very online Trumpists criticizing Kevin McCarthy for daring to put out a tweet about Marjorie Taylor Greene. And you know that Trump is watching this down in Mar-a-Lago. And Trump, you know, I know people keep saying that Trump's the leader of the Republican Party, but I think as you and I both know, Trump is also a follower. Trump will not let himself get crosswise with the Republican base. So he's got his finger up. And so what's going to happen to Marjorie Taylor Greene? Well, we won't know until we hear from Donald Trump. And here's a reminder, by the way, of what Donald Trump has said about Marjorie Taylor Greene in the past.
It's great to be with Marjorie, a very special person. She's out there fighting hard, and the people of Georgia love her.
Thank you so much, Mr. President, and the people love you. Thank you very
much. Also joining us tonight are Georgia representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene. I love Marjorie Taylor Greene. Come up here. Kelly wants you to come up here. Come here. With her. Don't mess with her.
So, Bill, Trump is not known for his loyalty, but he's going to be loath to throw, you know, a loud loyalist like Marjorie Taylor Greene under the bus as long as she's popular with the base, isn't he?
Yeah, that's right. And again, I come back to the no consequences. I was thinking about that after just, you know, as listening to those clips. It's not only that the base likes her and she gets raises all this money and small dollar donations. The let's call them the establishment Republicans who don't really like her, presumably, and kind of wish she would just be quiet. The Mitch McConnell types, maybe the Kevin McCarthy types. They pay no price for tolerating her. I always come back to that when we talk because the established Republicans seems to me things could be so different if from the beginning the establishment Republicans had drawn some clear lines and refused to go along with certain things. But they haven't. The donors haven't. I don't think the big establishment donors from New York and Dallas and so forth are giving a lot of money to Marjorie Taylor Greene, but they're not withholding money from Kevin McCarthy, from the National Republican Congressional Committee, from the Senatorial Committee, and from the party as a whole, because it tolerates Marjorie Taylor Greene. So you've got fervent supporters, you've got tolerant, you know, people who don't love her, but certainly are not cutting her off. And again, January 6th, right? What price have they paid? And the final point I'd make is, unfortunately, the polls don't show the party paying much of a price. One thing people said a few months ago is, oh my God, I mean, people are going to turn against the Republicans. Mm-hmm. They have this kind of fringe. And that's happened in the past, incidentally. You know, I think the Todd Akin probably hurt the whole Republican ticket a little bit in 2012. There's not much evidence so far that that she's hurt other Republican members of the House. I can't say the Democrats, frankly, have done a heck of a lot to sort of make her a burden and anchor on the other Republicans either. They pop off for a day when she says something, and then they kind of forget about it and go back, understandably, I guess, to their own legislation and their own issues. But, you know, I don't know, if I were running the Democratic Party, I think I would try make harder to make Marjorie Taylor Greene the face of the Republican Party. They have made, you know, AOC and Ilhan Omar and others fairly effectively, not really the face of the Democratic Party, but the face of the Democratic Party, at least to their own, to their right wing, to the Fox viewers and to Republican supporters, enough so that Republican donors can justify giving to the Republican Party because, oh my God, look at those terrifying Democrats. And you say to them, well, look, I don't like those Democrats, but they're a small minority of the caucus in the House. They're not winning on most issues. And Joe Biden's president. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene is closer to the center of the Republican Party than Ilhan Omar is to the center of the Democratic Party. But there's been very little effort and very little success, I'd say, in bringing that home to people.
No, I agree with that. So are you surprised with everything that's happened? Are you surprised that Republicans appear to be poised to block the independent bipartisan 9/11 style commission on January 6th? Does that surprise you?
Yeah, a little bit. I don't know. Does anything really surprise us anymore? I guess not. But you know, it's funny how it happens in this, as in other cases. I think you've written about this. They dip a toe in the water to see how damaging would it be to say maybe we got some objections to that. You make up some objections, which so the Democrats first of all give in basically to the Republican request for even representation on the commission and other aspects. They get 35 Republican votes in the House. There's a minute there where you think, ooh, those Republican senators have a little bit of a tough time opposing it. But then one or two dip their toe in the water and say, I'm not really happy about it. I still think it could be partisan. It may not be partisan exactly, but when they reject a subpoena request from the Democrats, then the media is going to blow it up. So it's still going to be bad for look partisan or bad for Republicans. And there's not much pushback on that. And then it turns out the donors don't care much and the conservative media doesn't care at all. I mean, that's, again, a big deal for me. If people who once I respected, if I can say that honestly, the Brit Humes of the world and stuff said, wait a second. I mean, you can be quite conservative on a bunch of issues and even quite Trump tolerant on a bunch of issues, but this is just a fake argument. You can't make that argument, Mitch McConnell. Then there might be, okay, I guess I really can't, but they get no pushback. And so it comes back for me always to the conservative elites and their willingness to just go along as the Republican elected officials, just go along with the base of the party in being totally, not just obstructionist, but really lying about, what's in the legislation that they're objecting to.
See, I struggle with that question about being surprised. I personally struggle with it because I'm pushing back against my own cynicism, because the reality is we should be surprised. We should be very surprised that Republicans are opposing something that is as obvious as the need to investigate what happened on January 6th. The polls would suggest that it's overwhelmingly popular. It's just simply the right thing to do. There's precedence. What happened on January 6th was so consequential, and it's ongoing. So, you know, in a rational universe, this would get 70, 75 votes. And the reality is that right now, there's a handful of Republicans that are willing to be in favor of it. And that's still shocking. So speaking of shocking, or not shocking, just to underline the point that the party is not moving on from this issue, this whole, fake argument that Liz Cheney had to go because she just kept talking about it and we need to stop talking about it and moving on. Here's former president on Newsmax last night, no, I'm sorry, 2 nights ago, continuing to push the big lie without any pushback whatsoever. Here's Trump.
You know, the election was a fraud. It was a rigged election. And when you look at what they did, it's so illegal. So I think things are happening at a very fast pace, much faster than people understand.
Sure. And listen, I
assume that he's talking about the fake audit in Arizona or other attempts to relitigate this. So Bill Kristol, I mean, say here you have, you know, Republicans voting, you say they're going to vote against the January 6th commission because they don't want to have to relitigate the 2020 election. That is all Trump is doing. That's all he wants to do. That's all the base wants to do. Relitigate this election, delegitimize this election, feed more doubts about whether or not our democracy is functioning anymore.
Yeah, and certainly I want to say a word about that, but one footnote about the 9/11 commission thing. I guess Senator Schumer may force a vote on that this week or maybe when they get back after. I'm a little unclear as we speak. But, they haven't really forced – the Republicans have stopped a lot of things without having to vote against them in an actual recorded vote. It will be a vote on a filibuster, not on the motion to proceed, I suppose, not on literally on the commission, but it will be a vote on the commission. And I think maybe that changes the dynamic a little. I don't quite understand why Pelosi and Schumer haven't just forced a ton more votes and make the Republicans oppose things that, as you say, are reasonably popular. Could that – I don't know if it matters much, but it'd be sort of interesting to see if that changes the dynamic at all. On the election, on the big lie, you make the key point in just the very end, which is it's extremely important for Trump and for the Republicans because it's important going forward. It's not just a matter of not getting over it or not moving on or he's a sore loser. Here again, I think the media's tendency to psychologize Trump so much and to really patronize him in a way can be misleading. They know what they're doing. This is their agenda going forward. It's not like no one's ever used a stolen election as a rallying cry for a party or a lost cause, unjustly taken away as a rallying cry for a party. It allows you to obscure a whole lot of other disagreements, not to have to come to agreement on a bunch of policies. It allows you to push your voting suppression and your legislation and rally people and run fundraise on that cause. And it's a party of grievance anyway, right? And so here's the grievance on top of all the other grievances. It's kind of the grievance that ties together all the grievances. You're unhappy about America. You're unhappy at the cultural institutions. You're unhappy about the liberals. You're unhappy about the universities. Well, this is sort of gives it a focal point in a sense. And so I think if you're a party of grievance, and this is an excellent grievance to rally everyone on, not just for the next year, unfortunately, but for the next 3 years.
But it's a grievance that also has real consequences for elections and for our democratic order. I mean, the other day we had Peter Wehner here on the podcast and to talk about, his warning that this lie is not just like any other lie. This lie is marching down the road to political violence, because if you really believe that the election was corrupt, this was the crime of the centuries, then it's not irrational to say that you engage in certain acts that would defend the Constitution, which we've already seen on January 6th. I mean, again, that's why I'm kind of tying the two together. January 6th was not a one-off. I mean, and it was not just a one-time event. This attack is ongoing.
That's very important. And the violence point is very important, too. And they don't want to. Not only do they want a memory, they do want a memory hole, January 6th, but they also don't want to really condemn January 6th in a forthright way, because there is a sort of relationship, you might say, between the anger they've got to stoke and a kind of permission for at least a certain amount of performative or demonstrative violence. Marjorie Taylor Greene is very relevant to this. We can go back to her for one more time.
Yeah.
What does it mean when you call your opponents Nazis? That's what she's done, right? Well, if your opponents are Nazis, you are entitled probably to use not violence against them, right? Not just civil disobedience, but actual violence. And so and everyone scoffs at it now or just finds it extremely distasteful and disgusting and just sort of says that. But people aren't thinking through where this goes in a year or two or three. And I, you know, on October 6th, if you had told us what was going to happen on January 6th, people would have said, you're crazy. On January 6th, the people would have said 5 months later, the party's going to be objecting to a 9/11 commission. They will have disciplined the members who speak up for coming to grips with what happened January 6th, and they will be tolerating and even praising often the ones who are memory-holing January 6th. I think we would have said, and Trump will be stronger than as strong as ever. I think we would have said, that's pretty crazy. And so I think, again, people have always been insufficiently attentive to the dynamic of these things. They don't. This is true of authoritarian movements. It's true of politics in general, right? It doesn't stay in one place, you know? And there is such a kind of snowballing of now of the extremism of the party and of conservatives. And then you look up occasionally, some conservative objects to something. You say, wow, that's great. But what he's objecting to is something that two or three years before would have been so beyond the pale that it wouldn't have even been a question that everyone would have objected. And now there's one writer in National Review who does think this has gone a little far, and everyone says, ooh, maybe that's a hopeful sign. So I don't mean to be a Debbie Downer here, but I think the last 6 months, 9 months have been terrible, really, for American democracy.
Well,
except for defeating Trump, that was
right, extremely important. No, right. But I do think that this trend is going to get worse. You know, again, I don't want to be the negative one here, and I apologize in advance. But people need to understand that if this grand jury in New York does in fact criminally indict Donald Trump, that's not going to loosen his control on the Republican Party, is it? I mean, it's just we've seen this. It's become the cliche about shooting somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue. And not losing a vote. The only thing that I think stops Donald Trump will be a felony conviction. And I'm not even sure of that because based on what I'm seeing, you can still run for president from prison. And that whole I'm a victim, they're going after our guy narrative plays into that as well. I mean, that's how sick things are.
I very much agree. Even if he does get convicted, which is many, many steps away, and is in prison, which would be many steps away from that with all the appeals and stuff, certainly the leading Republican candidates will run on a pledge to free him, to pardon him. And so as you and Amanda and others were saying maybe a week ago, you know, free Donald Trump will become a slogan in 2024. And it won't be, it's sort of funny now, but it's not going to be funny. And it will symbolize, again, contempt for the rule of law, contempt for the system of justice we have, contempt for the facts and the truth, and pure tribalism. And again, it's not hurt past authoritarians when they spent a little time in jail or when they were under investigation or the objects of trials. They become victims. And as we said earlier, victimhood is what you want to be in the current victimhood, but not really being a victim, you know,
right, pretending right. to be a victim. Play the card
is what you want to do. And I totally agree. I'm not so clear. I hope they do whatever's right in terms of the grand jury and the judicial system and the legal system. But I'm not at all convinced it weakens him much, if at all.
Okay, I want to talk about the upcoming possibility of a summit between President Biden and Vladimir Putin. Before we do this, I saw the other day that you tweeted out about something that's going on in Ohio because, you know, the craziness actually does have real-world consequences. Republicans in Ohio in the legislature appear poised to ban vaccine requirements. Actually, let me just read this one paragraph from a local Ohio Capital Journal. The Republican legislation in Ohio would ban vaccine requirements on customers, employees, or students from businesses, hospitals, nursing homes, K-12 schools, colleges, daycares, or others. It would also prevent governments, insurers, or businesses from offering incentives for people to get vaccinated or even requesting that people get vaccinated. Obviously, public health experts are appalled by this, but this is an indication, isn't it, of how the Republican Party has really either, you know, embraced or been taken over by the anti-vaxxers. This is amazing. This is happening in Ohio.
Yeah, the anti-masking, which sort of started off as a kind of just defensive Trump's handling of the pandemic, morphed into anti-vaccinations, even though sort of Trump sort of wants to take credit for the vaccine as well, and then merged with this sort of incredibly fake and stupid version of a kind of, oh, we're free, people should be free, you know, to do whatever they want. And now it's led them into not just crazy, but really dangerous position. We don't know. I don't know if this legislation is going to pass, but it's being taken seriously by some Republicans, at least in the Ohio state legislature. It's, you know, a kind of a mainstream state, you might say, with very distinguished medical institutions in it. You'd think they'd be a little more pushback against this kind of thing. I mean, it's really appalling, isn't it? You can't have any confidence that you send your son or daughter, or in our case, grandchildren, to a daycare center, and that the staff are vaccinated against certain things. I mean, you can't even ask, I suppose, because
you can't even ask.
Yeah. I mean, it's really you can't ask them to do that before you hire them. I mean, it's really. But I don't even know. You know, it's funny. I tweeted that myself. I read the article and I was shocked. But I'm trying to think, I mean, what does that mean? They've become so crazy that they go with whatever symbolically offends, I guess, the mainstream health community in this case, the sort of liberal establishment, the scientific establishment. But there's a kind of kookiness to it that's really, I mean, to go to this degree, it's one thing to deny climate change. I mean, you know, personally, you know, pay a price for that one way or the other. It doesn't have any real effect. You just say it and you enjoy shocking, you know, liberal opinion, which believes that that's an established fact. But this is different. I mean, people have children and grandchildren and friends and relatives who work in these places. And even so, they're willing to go along with this. It is sort of a different level of craziness, don't you think?
Yeah, it is. And it's completely performative. But also, do you remember like about 5 minutes ago that the conservatives used to say we need to balance rights with responsibilities.
Right.
This was our mantra that you had to have personal responsibility. And so, yes, maybe, you know, I mean, what's happened now is this distortion of freedom into whatever I want to do, regardless of its impact on others, which is a very weird flex on the idea of liberty and freedom, especially for conservatives. It's one thing to be hyper-individualistic and hyper-libertarian. It's another thing to ignore any consequences for the community. And this is an ongoing, I think, problem for people on the right. You know, freedom versus community, individual versus community, our responsibility to others. But this is one where you are, you know, quite literally putting other lives at risk because you simply don't want to do the responsible thing. Okay, so.
But also on that, I mean, you've actually commented on this. Yeah. It's not even sincere in the sense that it's not as if there are principled libertarians who wildly, I think, in my view, and I imagine yours too, you know, bend much too far in the side of individual liberty as opposed to individual responsibility or communal, you know, responsibility to the community. But of course, the same Republicans who are proposing this anti-vax legislation are probably at the same time endorsing all kinds of micromanagement of curricula to make sure that, you know, critical race theory, or not even critical race theory, but any mention of race is in any curriculum in the Ohio schools and so forth. So it's not as if they're consistently, you know, for government staying out of all these things or for state legislatures not telling people what to do or say or think. It is all about somehow the power of their exercising power on their side against the bad guys, against who are the establishment, I guess, the liberal establishment.
Yeah, it is interesting watching the right embrace relativism in this particular way. So let's talk about the Biden-Putin summit. I know that you had a conversation with Garry Kasparov about this the other day. What worries you?
So, I mean, you know, Putin has behaved very badly, to say the least, over the last years, and including during the Biden presidency, obviously, especially with Navalny, and he's behind Belarus and Lukashenko and this, you know, abduction of this dissident from a flight from, what was it, Athens to Latvia, which is an extraordinary thing to do. And there's been some condemnation, including from the Biden administration, but no reconsidering of this summit, which is happening. Why? I mean, it's unclear to me that, you know, I mean, there are plenty of meetings at the lower levels. This summit benefits Putin. I mean, if you're a dictator and there were big demonstrations against him just a few months ago, and he's got Navalny in jail, who's very popular, and he's got the other problems in the country, and people are more aware than they were before, partly because of Navalny, of the degree of theft and by Putin and his cronies, the incredible wealth they've amassed. Now you're just making him equal to the United States president on the world stage. For what? And I am, I don't think it's going to be good. It will strengthen Putin internally. There's always a tendency in these summits, even with presidents that I've liked, no one wants to be you don't want to cause a huge ruckus. So you sort of quickly walk through your talking points that are, even when I was in the White House, I could see this occasionally. You walk through the talking points that are the kind of the tough ones, and then you decide, well, we can agree generally that we need to have better relations. And it sends a signal to the dissidents there and elsewhere in the other regimes that Putin supports that we're not willing to really fight for them. So I don't think it's the worst thing in the world necessarily. Eric Edelman and I were talking, who's written a lot for The Bulwark and has been on your podcast, I think. Mm-hmm. And I were talking about this the other day. We both remembered vaguely, and he, of course, knows 10,000 times more about it than I do. I remembered vaguely, and he remembered specifically. Remembered studying, and he teaches about this, actually. The Kennedy-Khrushchev summit, so that was a new Democratic president in 1961. They had a summit in June, actually, so it would be exactly 60 years. Almost exactly 60 years before Biden Putin. Total disaster. Yep. Khrushchev really took Kennedy to the cleaners. Kennedy knew it was a disaster at the time. And it emboldened the Soviet Union, and many people think led to the Cuban Missile Crisis, really, because Khrushchev decided he could just push Kennedy around. And all the Berlin Wall went up a few months after that, too. So hope it doesn't lead to, those kinds of consequences. But it's not a good thing. Biden's been pretty good on the kind of human rights, democracy, standing up to dictators front. But I'm worried now. There's no sign he wants to do anything about the Beijing Olympics, the summit with Putin, a certain retreat, I think, because it's tough. It's tough to confront dictators, and they can do things in response that make our life a little more difficult. But I'm worried about that.
Do you have any insight into what was behind the Biden administration's decision to lift the sanctions on that major pipeline? One would have thought that might have come after some sort of concession from the Russians.
That's a good point.
I don't get that.
And that's sort of, again, maybe you want to hold that over them at least for the summit and get, as you say, get a concession. So I think he wanted to. The Germans care a lot about it. The current German government is for it, I guess. And so it was a kind of way to reach out to pacify our allies. Sometimes that's worth doing, even if you pay a price. But again, it wasn't explained well, and it wasn't. And again, the way in which it's done just seemed to be sort of weak. And so he's doing the summit. I don't quite know the details, but I think the summit will come after a meeting with our allies, a NATO meeting, I believe, and slightly before that in June. And so that's a chance where you could really have a good gathering, unlike Trump's NATO meetings, which were always, contentious and sort of, we barely made it through without the alliance breaking up. You could have a sort of strengthening of the U.S.-European bonds. Why overshadow that with a meeting with Putin? I just think it's a bad decision in several ways.
Okay, here's another decision that I'm not sure that I fully understand. Maybe you can explain to me. The decision by the Biden Department of Justice to appeal the decision by the Judge Jackson to release the whole Bill Barr-era memo on why they weren't going to go ahead and charge, or why they didn't think they could charge Donald Trump with obstruction of justice. She issued this scathing opinion saying that it needed to be released because it clearly was kind of a smoking gun about how the Department of Justice under Barr had lied to the public about what was going on, the way that it spun the whole Mueller report. And yet, the Biden Justice Department is like, okay, yeah, we're going to stick with the policy of keeping that under wraps. I don't quite get it.
Or keeping some of it under wraps, I think. I haven't quite followed it in detail enough, and I know there are people I respect who are, some of them are upset about it. I think the Justice Department shouldn't be appealing. Others say no, they're appealing on sort of reasonable grounds that any Justice Department, in a sense, would want to preserve some confidentiality, but they're letting enough of it out. And of course, the judge's opinion is public, so that all much of it, and that already is making the point you made. So Actually, I would put it that one. I'm sort of willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. And in this respect, I think it's a good if occasionally the Biden Justice Department is acting in a way that's a little bit too much almost in the way traditional justice departments act, i.e. protecting the confidentiality of presidential communications, even for a previous president. In a way, maybe that's a good thing, you know, because it means that it's not, no one can say that Merrick Garland is politicizing him. The Democrats want this. The partisan Democrats want it all out. Merrick Garland saying, look, my lawyers have convinced me that the prudent thing here is to go down this middle path. Without knowing enough to have any judgment on the details of the middle path, I think in a way, maybe it's a good thing to remind people that you can have a Justice Department that doesn't just do what's in the narrow political interests of the current president.
Fair enough. Okay, so let's talk for a moment about the passing of Senator John Warner.
Yeah.
I'm only struck by the way in which he does feel like someone from another political era, Republican senator from Virginia. And I'm reading a Twitter thread from Democratic Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, who we've talked about before. She's been a guest on this podcast, centrist Democrat. She's writing about a Republican senator. She said, Senator Warner deeply loved this country and he was proud to be a Virginian. His devotion to our nation, our national security, and those in uniform was remarkable. He was a strong proponent of bipartisanship, and he valued any opportunity for Virginia's elected officials to come together on an issue and make progress for our commonwealth. Even after his 30 years in the Senate had finished, he was willing to share stories, both inspiring and humorous, from his long life of public service with newly elected officials like me. I always appreciated his generosity, his wisdom, and his mentorship. This loss is monumental, but Senator Warner's example of leadership and principle will endure and inspire many generations of Virginians. So doesn't this feel like a postcard from another world where Democrats are writing that way about Republicans? And we remember a Republican senator who had that kind of approach to governance?
Yeah, very much so. His whole life is I mean, he volunteered for the Navy as a just before his 18th birthday, and somehow got in January of 1945. As you know, World War II continued to go on. He wanted to serve, got out. I think went back to college. I think maybe then to law school. Maybe it was already law school at that point. And then in 1950, when the Korean War breaks out, he joins the re-enlists in the Marine Corps this time. So I'm not going to know how that worked, but anyway, and was a Marine in Korea. I think an aircraft mechanic or something like that. So, you know, very George H.W. Bush-like, I would say, you know, a certain kind of patrician. I mean, you know, from a well-to-do family feeling.
He looked like a senator too, didn't he? I mean, he looked like a senator.
Totally, yeah. And of course, I was looking at some of the obits. I knew him a little bit. I didn't really know him when he was married to Elizabeth Taylor, so I missed the chance to meet her. That was a problem, but I don't, at least I don't recall that. But I knew him a little bit because, so he was always on armed services and became chairman and ranking member. Dan Quayle, my boss, had been on the Armed Services Committee, kind of how he made his name in the Senate. And then, so when Dan Quayle was vice president, I mean, John Warner, I mean, A, would come by just because there was a lot of business, you know, the Bush administration was doing with a key armed services senator, and also because they were friendly and he had been kind of a mentor to Vice President Quayle. And he was very gracious. I really want to say that. I mean, some people like that, it's sort of like they deal with the boss and then the staff are kind of there to get you coffee. He was always pleasant. And someone told a story on Twitter of a couple of stories of him being, you know, which is my experience too, being a very kind person and a very decent person and a real patriot, a gentleman, and very much an anti-Trump Republican. He was a fan. The last conversation I had with him, I can't remember, I don't think it was in person, I think it was in the pandemic, and I wasn't close to him. He didn't call me up or anything. I think we must have been on a Zoom call together or something with, you know, a bunch of people. But he was a Republican voter against Trump and a supporter of that, and hoped, I don't know how much he hoped anymore for a sane Republican Party, but he was unembarrassed to support Biden. He was not one of those who was like, oh, well, I'm writing in, you know, someone else. I mean, he thought Biden was better than Trump, and he thought it was his responsibility to say so. And so I didn't agree with him always when he was a senator. I was more on the kind of Reagan side of the party, and he was very much of a Ford Bush, you might say, Republican. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, you read the obits and you read what he did in the Senate and you read about him personally, and you think, man, what a different Republican Party. And, you know, it's good. Incidentally, I give the Democrats are using this a little bit, obviously. I mean, some of them were sincere. The ones from Virginia got to know him a little bit. The others are using it as a little bit of a way to attack the current Republicans. So we shouldn't give the Democrats, I suppose, too much credit. But I do give them credit for being, you know, willing. It's important to have one party recognize decency in the other party. And in that respect, the public statements by Spanberger, but many others as well, including Mark Warner, who started his career running against John Warner in 1996, it's been heartening to see that. It'd be nice to get back to that at some point in our politics, obviously.
It would be. Not speaking of Biden, the Democrats seem to have gotten, shall we say, mired down on their legislative agenda. I think it was Politico Playbook that said that, or is it Washington Post? I can't remember. I read so much stuff that they're basically now blowing past a lot of self-imposed deadlines and legislation. Very clearly, they were not able to get police reform done by the anniversary of George Floyd. That's still obviously working. Infrastructure deal doesn't seem likely. So, I mean, everybody's looking around right now going, okay, so when are we going to acknowledge that this whole bipartisan thing is a non-starter, despite the best efforts, I think, of Joe Biden personally, who I believe was sincere when he said during the campaign that he thought that he could forge some bipartisan compromises, but it was perhaps an indication of the fact that he hadn't quite grasped how much politics had changed. So what do you think right now about where the Democrats are at? Because it kind of feels they're kind of in their own quagmire where nothing's moving at the moment.
Yeah, I think it's uncertain. I mean, things could move, obviously, in June and July, and then there'll be a break, and then September will be a big month. And I think certainly by Labor Day and certainly by September 30th, the end of the fiscal year, we'll really have a sense of where we are on some of these legislative priorities and also on the general, you know, how much cooperation is possible in the congressional process in general. That 9/11 commission vote will be a bit of a tell, though, and I wouldn't blame the Democrats looking at that to think, geez, we can't get more than 3 or 4 votes on this. Are we really going to get votes on this other stuff? Well, people think the police reform bill may go through in a bipartisan way. There's a kind of anti-China, but good bill, I think, mostly pro-American kind of competitiveness and innovation and technological progress kind of bill, marketed kind of as an anti-China bill, I guess, keeping up with China, that has bipartisan support. If I'm not mistaken, it got out of whatever the relevant committee was, 21-1, I think, maybe it was foreign relations. So, you know, if a couple of those things pass, it could change the mood a bit. Things can change pretty abruptly in Congress. So I think we'll see. I guess generally, I think the Democratic Party, and this may sound a little funny. I mean, they're both not quite alarmed enough about democracy and therefore are not willing to broaden their tent enough and make some compromises to get people on board to save democracy. That is, I mean, I find myself a third of the time agreeing almost with the left that sort of the moderate Democrats are a little too complacent, but then the other two-thirds of the time agreeing with the moderate Democrats that precisely if you are really alarmed, you need to get rid of some of your wish list and focus on what really is important. So in the voting rights area, you can't get all of H.R. 1 through. Could you get a smaller bill through that's sort of John Lewis Voting Rights Act and a few voting protection measures? So I kind of think they haven't quite adjusted to the moment, but to be fair, it's not so easy, right? They have a new administration. No. They're all in power. They're trying to pass their agenda. And it's hard for them to also sort of think through. I mean, it's easy for people on the outside to say, oh, can you believe Joe Biden talked himself into thinking that it was like the people he dealt with 10 years ago, let alone 30 years ago. Fair enough. But I don't know. I mean, I think it's the Republican Party situation is so unusual at this point. I mean, you can say McConnell was obstructionist, obviously, with Obama and all that, but that a different level and in a different way. And so I give them a little time to adjust and develop, sort of revise their legislative strategy, I guess, and we'll see how they do.
Well, and this is my mantra that following up on your point about the Democrats not being sufficiently alarmed, is that if this is an existential crisis, act like it is an existential crisis. And I guess that's the question. Is it business as usual? I also get the sense that perhaps the Biden White House and Democrats have bought in too much to that adage that when your opponent is digging a hole, like, what how does it go? You know,
don't interrupt him.
If your Republican is, and if your opponent is committing suicide, don't get in his way or something. These things always need a hand. They always need a push. I think the sort of the hands-off approach, you know, probably sounds good internally. But you're right. I don't get the fact that I don't think that they have been pushing the narrative lines strong enough, certainly not with the kind of discipline that you see on the right, the Republicans and the conservative media. I mean, they have their mantras down almost to the syllable. Have you noticed this? It really is quite remarkable.
And for a party that allegedly has the support for a movement almost that has the support of all these horrible left-wing billionaires who are so clever and are destroying America in so many ways. So in Ohio, there's this bill that we were discussing earlier. Now, maybe this is going to happen. I don't know. But shouldn't, I mean, George Soros or people like him be spending a few million dollars in Ohio to say what this is your Ohio Republican Party? They want you to send your kid to a daycare center where you have no assurance that anyone has been vaccinated against the measles or against other diseases that your kid could catch. They don't want to let them ask whether the other kids have been vaccinated when you send your kid there. Is that what you want as a parent? But you know, you got to take advantage of these things when they're in the news, right? when they're alive. Now, does that ultimately change how people vote in, you know, 18, 19 months from now? Probably not. Does it affect a little bit though? Does it lay the groundwork for a campaign in 2022 that says these people are extreme and they're willing to tolerate extremists in their midst? I think it could. So yeah, I kind of agree. For all the talk about how powerful that kind of left-wing network of foundations and billionaires and partisans is, they don't seem to be doing that much to make Republicans pay a price for pretty grotesque irresponsibility.
No, you actually got me thinking of something, because what you have is the right wing at the state level really at ramming speed. And we've had all of this talk about whether or not the Democrats are overreaching, misreading their mandate at the national level. And the answer might be maybe they are. But at the state level, you're seeing the exact opposite, where you have this extreme legislation, the Ohio bill that would ban even, you know, encouraging people to get a vaccination. I mean, that's an issue that I think could be salient, you know, for certain swing voters. In Texas, are you seeing what they're doing with the gun laws? This is a fight that I'm really familiar with, by the way. It's not sufficient, apparently, for the Second Amendment advocates to have concealed carry with permits. Now they are pushing through legislation, and apparently it's going to be passed and signed into law, that will allow people to carry guns without any training, without any background checks, without any permits of any kind. Now that takes an idea that I think has some merit, and it makes it crazy to have anyone be able to carry a gun without any indication they know how to use it, without any background check, without any way for law enforcement to determine whether or not this is somebody that, you know, can reasonably be trusted with a firearm. I didn't put that well. But we went through this fight in Wisconsin a few years ago when we had been pushing for concealed carry legislation for years, and finally we're poised to do this with a permit, with a background check, maybe with some sort of training requirement. And the NRA folks decided that wasn't enough. They wanted no permits, no background, nothing. And I thought this was completely nuts. And eventually they kind of went away. But what really struck me is that most gun owners, at least in Wisconsin, even people who are really strong supporters of the Second Amendment, don't support this kind of completely untethered from reality legislation. Most people, you know, think that if you handle a gun, you have a strong moral and should have a legal obligation to know that you can handle it safely. How did we get to this point? This strikes me as another one of those moments where this performative, hyper-individualist, you know, freedom uber alles, as opposed to any sort of sense of responsibility or community, kicks in, because you want people to be in favor of Second Amendment rights, then reassure them that people are rational and reasonable and trained and have background checks and have permits, as opposed to any freaking redneck out there with a gun. I mean, again, in Ohio with the vaccines, Texas with the guns, you have the right overreaching and at ramming speed.
No, I very much agree. And you'd think that the performative overreach, if I can put it this way, and you see it on a bunch of issues, actually, in the session of state legislatures and then by individual members of Congress, you'd think they would pay some price for that. That is, they are now out of touch, at least based on the polls, with their own voters, who were, of course, not in favor of various left-wing proposals to restrict, you know, take away their guns, if you want to use a caricature or whatever the equivalent would be. But are not, or maybe in favor of opening up faster than the public health authorities think wise in terms of summer camps or restaurants, or maybe not even faster than some of the public health authorities who are being too slow. But yeah, but then the legislators have gone way to the other extreme. You'd think that some of their own voters would make them pay a little bit of a price for this. But somehow it's almost not even taken seriously. It's so performative. I guess they get away with being more extreme because people don't hold them, you know, there's no consequence in a sense for their legislation. But as you say, in Texas, they're really going to sign this bill and, you know, someone's going to get hurt. And I don't know, will anyone then say, look what's happened? But maybe the whole fight is so polarized. Maybe this is what polarization means, that in a sense, you pay no price for even a super irresponsible version of your own position, as it were, of what otherwise could be a sensible position. You see it on the critical race theory thing that you've written about. And look, I might attack you, but you made a perfectly sensible point about not liking much of critical race theory to the degree it's a thing, but, you know, but also, you know, not agreeing with the most extreme denunciations and legislation that would stop people from talking about, I don't know, race or slavery, you know, in history classes. And people just are, but I'm so struck watching people in this area. And this includes people at think tanks and people at journalism and on the right at Fox. They pay no price, and there's a huge reward, I would even say, for not being at all, to use the term, fair and balanced, for not being at all sensible or even fact-based in what they say. And it's just used as sort of, what was Bill Clinton's term? Or Pat Moynihan's term for Bill Clinton on welfare, boo bait for the bubbas. You know, it's just stuff you throw out there, chum you throw out there to keep your, you know, the kind of least knowledgeable fans kind of excited.
Well, let me end on a hopeful note that perhaps there, yes, in an era of polarization, nobody pays any price because everybody's just locked in. So if you're in favor of the Second Amendment, you'll be in favor of anything, you know, but my hopeful note would be that maybe there's 4 or 5% of the electorate out there who are genuine swing voters who are looking at this and are repelled by it, who are thinking, I don't want to be part of this movement that, you know, wants guns everywhere. I don't want to be part of this movement that wants to eliminate vaccinations for my kids. I'm out. And in many areas of the country, in some of these swing districts, that 4 or 5% could be determinative. So who knows?
That is hopeful. And the Democrats, like you mentioned, Spanberger, and here in Virginia, Congresswoman Spanberger and others like that, they need to explicitly say, we want the votes of those of you who voted for John Warner, right? I mean, you can't just be, you know, we're going to have demographic change, so we just got to mobilize every Democrat and every 19-year-old sophomore in college. I think you do need the votes in Virginia here where I live. Democrats need the votes of people who voted for and respect, and if they were too young to vote for, they respect the memory of someone like a John Warner Republican.
Bill Kristol, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. We always appreciate it.
My pleasure, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.